possibly to more severe weather and further increases in food prices. Professor Wynne Morgan of Sheffield University, one of the report's authors, said, "Given we expect climate impacts to get worse, it is likely that climate change will continue to fuel a cost-of-living crisis for the foreseeable future." Anna Taylor, the executive director at the Food Foundation, said the government needed to think more seriously how households can become more resilient to price volatility in the light of the likely impact of the climate crisis. Anna Taylor called on the government to revive its plans for a horticulture strategy that would build production of fruit and vegetables in the United Kingdom and reduce reliance on crops grown in southern Europe, which is becoming increasingly vulnerable to drought and extreme heat as a result of the climate crisis. A separate report from the Food Foundation warned that retailers and hospitality venues in Britain were failing to create a food environment where healthy choices are affordable, readily available and appealing. It found healthy food was already twice as expensive as unhealthy food per calorie, while the cost of sustainable alternatives to meat and dairy can also be high. According to the report, most main meals offered by many pub chains regularly exceed 50% of the recommended daily intake for calories, saturated fat, salt and sugar. Meanwhile, just 1% of food advertising spent goes towards fruit and vegetables, compared with 9% on meat and dairy products, while 21.5% of buy one, get one free deals are on meat and dairy, compared with just 4.5% on fruit and vegetables. Lancaster said the dependence of Britain's current farming system on volatile oil, gas, fertilizer prices has created a perfect storm of extreme weather, high gas prices and global instability to food price inflation. Lancaster added, "The important news is that steps to make farming more sustainable cannot only cut emissions but also make our food production more resilient to the extremes of flooding and drought." The British government plans in England to support greener farming with more hedge grows, improved soil health and tree planting schemes are therefore vital to our future food security. Euronews has also covered the same story and tells us more. A recent survey found rising prices have pushed almost one-third of Europeans into a precarious financial situation. The second European barometer on poverty and precariousness examined Europeans' ability to make purchases and found that it had declined over the past 3 years, forcing a majority of them skip meals and resort to making difficult financial choices. Of the 10,000 people surveyed by Ipsos for French Secours Populaire, 29% said their financial situation was precarious and any unexpected expenses would make their balance tip. Nearly one in two Europeans think that they face a high risk of falling into a precarious situation in the next few months, succumbing to rising prices and relatively stagnant pay. According to Eurostat, the 2021 at-risk of poverty rate for the total population of the European Union stood at 17%. Only 15% said they were confident and did not feel the need to pay attention to their everyday expenses. According to the survey results, a vast majority of Europeans have already had to compromise on their choices due to difficult financial conditions. Rampant inflation in almost every sector forced these complicated choices, which include skipping a meal despite being hungry. Almost one in three Europeans said they have skipped a meal when hungry, with Greece and Moldova having particularly high numbers.
Aperture.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet or you put it on the end of a shell and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could
you tell us about leaving Kuwait?
how it happened for you.
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem. And he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory 7 times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people, and less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramoni, Turutaš Ljubica, Lavušić Gospod, Udorić.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by. And they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevic is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadići, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests reveal that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans, Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump, 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. A tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which, when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Limelight. An influential group of economists say Britain's economy is in a horrible fiscal bind as it heads for recession with no room to cut taxes or increase public spending to offer a boost. We take a look at some of the World Person Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. The Bank of England has warned that Britain risks falling into recession next year as British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak gears up for an election battle. In a bleak assessment for 2024, Threadneedle Street policymakers slash forecasts for Britain's growth to zero as the Monetary Policy Committee held interest rates at 5.25% for the second straight meeting. While the Bank of England's central forecast is no growth next year, uncertainties mean there is a 50% chance of a recession by the middle of 2024. Andrew Bailey, Governor of the Bank of England, warned there was uncertainty around the impact of the Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip on oil prices. The Bank of England said even in the best-case scenario, Prime Minister Sunak will be campaigning against the backdrop of a stagnant economy and an extended period of higher borrowing costs. The bank's latest projection for next year fell from a previous forecast of 0.5%, while it also warned that annual growth will remain below 1% for the next 4 years, down from 2.75% in the decade before the financial crisis. It said weaker economic activity was now weighing down on the job market. Despite the weaker outlook for jobs and growth, Andrew Bailey said it was much too early to be thinking about interest rate cuts. He said the next move in interest rates was more likely to be up than down as Britain continues its fight to get inflation back to 2%. Andrew Bailey added, "We'll be watching closely to see if further interest rate increases are needed." In language echoing that of US Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell, on Wednesday night, 1st of November, he added, "Higher interest rates are working and inflation is falling, but we need to see inflation continuing to fall all the way to our 2% target." Andrew Goodwin from Oxford Economics said the decision was a surprisingly hawkish hold. He claimed, however, the policy debate has clearly moved on over the past couple of months, with further interest rate hikes unlikely. But Alan Monks from JP Morgan warned that borrowers could still be in for a pain if labour markets, wage growth and services inflation cool too slowly. Alan Monks said, "Although we think the Bank of England is on hold from here, the vote is already at 6-3 and significantly hawkish developments in the data would push it into hiking further." Policymakers said they expected the economy and labour market to stagnate for the rest of the year as pay growth starts to slow from record highs. While inflation is likely to drop to 3.8% by next March and around 3.6% in the spring, the Bank of England does not expect price rises to hit the bank's 2% target for two more years. Policymakers said stubborn inflation suggests that higher rates would need to weigh on the economy for an extended period of time to keep a lid on price rises. Despite the lackluster outlook for growth as higher borrowing costs slow down the economy, Andrew Bailey told reporters, if we don't get inflation down, then the pain is worse. Conflicts in West Asia also presented upside risk to inflation from energy prices, as Bank of England staff raised their oil and gas price forecasts for the next 3 years. The bank believes that just half the impact of higher interest rates has so far fed through to the economy. Unemployment is predicted to hit 5% by 2025, from 4.2% on Thursday, as the bank warned that the recent period of inflation was likely to leave the unemployment rate permanently higher. According to a survey of the bank's agents, higher mortgage rates were increasingly weighing on housing demand, with transactions roughly down by a fifth and prices down by around 5% over the past year. Its report said most expected broadly similar falls in prices over the year ahead. The survey added that while there had not been a big jump in people missing their mortgage payments, the credit profile of applicants has worsened owing to weaker disposable income. It also suggested that renters, who are less likely to have significant savings and typically earn less than homeowners, would continue to see rents soar. The 9 members of the Monetary Policy Committee that set interest rates voted 6-3 to keep them on hold, with Hawke's Catherine Mann and Jonathan Haskell joined by Megan Green in warning that the still tight jobs market means rates of 5.5% were warranted. British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. An influential group of economists said Britain's economy is in a horrible fiscal bind as it heads for recession, with no room to cut taxes or increase public spending to offer a boost. The Institute for Fiscal Studies warned that Britain will slump into a moderate recession in the first half of 2024 as the struggle for growth remains while borrowing costs stay elevated. It comes as the Bank of England's chief economist warned that there was still work to do to bring Britain's inflation back under control, a hint that the base interest rate could rise yet again. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was little room for the tax cuts wanted by Tory MPs anytime soon in its green budget assessment of the nation's public finances ahead of Chancellor Jeremy Hunt's autumn statement. Using analysis by Citi, the Institute for Fiscal Studies report warned that the United Kingdom would fall into recession at the start of 2024 that will last for 9 months. It also forecasts that gross domestic product or GDP would slump by 0.7% next year. Paul Johnson, the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, said, "We are in a horrible fiscal bind. The price of our high levels of indebtedness, failure to stimulate growth and high borrowing costs is likely to be a protracted period of high taxes and tight spending." The Institute for Fiscal Studies said there was no room for tax cuts or spending hikes despite a 6-year freeze on income tax thresholds would mean an extra £52 billion a year by 2027. The equivalent of raising the basic and higher rate of income tax by 6 pence. Johnson said the amount raised by the fiscal drag process pushes people into higher income tax brackets as pay increases was extraordinary. Meanwhile, the Labour Party said the so-called stealth tax rise showed that the Tories had crashed the economy. Darren Jones, the shadow chief treasury secretary, said successive failures by Conservative ministers have left us with low growth, high taxes and national debt as at the highest level in generations. The Institute for Fiscal Studies cautioned Rishi Sunak's government could come under pressure to increase public spending by more than planned, as it offered a stark assessment of the situation a Labour government faces if it wins the 2024 general election. The report said beyond March of 2025, There are likely to be real-term cuts to the day-to-day budgets of many governmental departments and falling spending on investment in public services. It comes despite growing pressure to improve services such as the National Health Service and to commit to spending in areas such as defence and childcare. Government borrowing is also set to be around £20 billion lower this year than the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, predicted in March of this year. But debt levels have soared as borrowing costs have gone up and the inflation rate remains above target. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said that interest rates are set to remain above 5% until mid-2024, when the Bank of England could begin steadily cutting rates. But the bank faces its own challenge of bringing down inflation while avoiding a deeper recession, which could be worsened by higher interest rates. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the Monetary Policy Committee may want to wait for firm evidence of disinflation before it considers cutting interest rates. But by that point, it might be too late and the result could be a deep recession. The Bank of England's chief economist, Hugh Pill, said recently that there was more work to do to fight inflation, in a hint that the base rate could rise again from its current level of 5.25%. Hugh Pill said, "We still have some work to do in order to get back to the inflation target of 2%. And we probably have some work to do to ensure that when we get back to 2%, we do so in a way that is sustainable through time."
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The issue of Palestine is the first issue of the world of Islam, by Ayatollah Khamenei. Palestine, a big wound on the body of the Islamic Ummah. March 4, 2010. Take a look at the conditions of Palestine in the present time. Palestine is only an example. Of course, it is a very important example, but the situation is not particular to Palestine. Take a look at Palestine and see that the Islamic Ummah suffers from a great wound, which is the disaster that has befallen the great people and the historical land and the holy land of Palestine. What have they done to this land? What have they done to these people? What are they doing to them in the present time? Is the event of Gaza forgettable? Is it possible to erase it from the mind of the Islamic Ummah? The pressures, savage acts, cruelties, and the oppressions that have been committed against the people of Gaza continue to exist even after the 22-day war, during which the Zionist government was defeated and failed to achieve its goals. But despite these crimes, the Islamic Ummah cannot defend them. The Islamic Ummah has faced this phenomenon as if it were not related to it. It behaves as though it were not its right to stand up against this usurpation. It behaves as though this oppression were not shown against it. Why are we like this? Why has the Islamic Ummah faced this situation? A dangerous and deadly cancer, namely the fake Zionist and Israeli government, has been created by the enemies of Islam and the Islamic Ummah. Its supporters, who have collaborated with it in showing oppression and committing great sins, continue to support it, while the Islamic Ummah cannot defend itself. This is our weakness. Why is that? We should make up for this weakness by returning to Islam and pivoting around the teachings of the Holy Prophet of Islam.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The path to liberating Palestine is nothing but resistance. February 27, 2010. The path of Quds, the path of Palestine, and the path of resolving the issue of Palestine is the path of fighting. As was pointed out by the gentleman in this meeting, there is no other path for Palestine. I am happy to see that all of you agree with and believe in this issue. Those people who do not accept this path, whether knowingly or unknowingly, are delivering a blow to the issue of Palestine.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After weeks of continuous Israeli regime bombardment of Gaza, the real death toll is likely much higher than what has already been reported. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, it took just one mention of the more than 15,000 Palestinians killed in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza for senior Netanyahu advisor Mark Regev to revert to the line that these are Hamas numbers. In a recent interview with Mehdi Hassan on MSNBC, Regev refused to acknowledge that the Zionist regime had killed children in its relentless and indiscriminate bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip, suggesting that the hours of heart-wrenching footage aired daily could not be independently verified. It is true that over the weeks of war in Gaza, the process of gathering and verifying information and footage has become extremely difficult and sometimes impossible. But the primary reason for this is Israel's ongoing push to control the narrative. The Zionist regime has totally sealed off the territory, refusing to grant permission for foreign journalists to enter the war zone. At the same time, at least 53 media workers have been killed in the war since October 7th, making it the deadliest conflict for reporters since the Committee to Protect Journalists began collecting data in 1992. Sharif Abdul Quddus, an independent journalist who worked on an award-winning film about the Zionist regime's killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh in May 2022, said in an interview with Democracy Now, "You have a situation where you're killing most of the registered journalists in Gaza, and you are not letting other journalists in." Nadim Hawri, executive director of the Paris-based Arab Reform Initiative, told Middle East Eye that Israel is deliberately seeking to control information flow from Gaza. He added, noting that the world is witnessing a full narrative war with Israel deploying its usual arsenal, it is also trying to influence coverage through deliberate misinformation. He compared the situation to the lead-up to the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, when claims from the Bush administration were parroted by mainstream media without scrutiny. This had devastating consequences then, and this is having devastating consequences today. Journalists and media workers who aren't directly killed by the Zionist regime's shelling have been paralyzed by the devastation of communication networks due to ongoing bombardments and the absence of fuel and electricity. At the start of the war, the Zionist regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, declared a full siege on the population of 2.3 million people in Gaza, citing a fight against human animals, as he claimed. Other journalists have lost their families in Israeli airstrikes on civilian structures, including Al Jazeera correspondent Wael Dahoudo, who received news of the killing of his wife, son, daughter, and grandson while live on air. Despite the Zionist regime's blackout on Gaza, the casualty numbers provided by local authorities and international organizations are widely seen as reliable, just as they have been in past wars. On rare occasions, the Zionist regime's military has allowed reporters from international news networks to embed with its troops in Gaza, on condition that they surrender their materials to Israeli authorities before publication. Mohammad Shahada, chief of communications at the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor, told Middle East Eye, "Any journalist, foreign journalist, going into Gaza is going in on three conditions. Stick to Israeli tours, go where they want to go, and see what they want you to see." Journalists embedding with the Israeli regime troops have been barred from speaking with Palestinians, Shahada added, pointing to some of the international coverage of the siege of Ashrafa Hospital, which did not include Palestinian voices, even as thousands were sheltering inside the facility. The Zionist regime's chokehold on information from Gaza is just one aspect of its efforts to control the narrative. Israel's permanent representative to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, has taken his government's campaign against Hamas numbers to another level. While sitting at the Security Council, Erdogan recently launched a tirade of accusations against the UN itself, saying, "Every number from the so-called Ministry of Health is Hamas. Many UNRWA workers in Gaza are themselves members of Hamas," he claimed, adding, "The time has come to bust the myth of UN-supplied facts." His comments weren't the least bit surprising. Since the beginning of this war, more than 100 UNRWA workers in Gaza have been killed in Israeli regime attacks, some of which have targeted schools turned shelters funded and operated by the agency. ¶¶ This is despite the fact that all the agency's staff in Gaza are vetted and their names shared with the Zionist regime. Julia Tuma, spokesperson for UNRWA, told the New York Times. Alessandro Accorsi, a senior analyst of technology and conflict with the International Crisis Group, told MEE that in past conflicts, while the Israeli regime army has been slow to release casualty figures, the data has more or less aligned with that of the Gaza Health Ministry. But the current war is different. As the tide of international public opinion shifts in favor of Palestinians, the international blank check the Zionist regime had at the beginning of the war to fight Hamas is running out. Of course, he said, if Israel had to confirm the death toll now, this would give a big push to calls for a humanitarian ceasefire. Indeed, after weeks of continuous Israeli regime bombardment of Gaza, many analysts warn that the real death toll is likely much higher than what has already been reported, due to the near impossibility of tracking and documenting every case. Thousands of bodies are believed to still be trapped under the rubble, while others have likely been buried without official notice. What the Zionist regime calls Hamas numbers could indeed be wrong, not because they are inflated, but because they do not capture the full extent of the horrifying reality on the ground in Gaza.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The ongoing boycott campaign against pro-Israeli products has set in motion a transformative period for Western businesses in Pakistan. Faced with a resounding call for boycott, pro-US and pro-Israeli companies find themselves compelled to make strategic adjustments. In response, these outlets have slashed their product prices by up to 50%, a desperate measure to bring customers back to their shops. However, the people of Pakistan remain steadfast in their commitment to uphold the boycott as a demonstration of solidarity with the oppressed communities in Gaza.
I am fully behind the boycott against pro-US and pro-Israeli companies. It's heartbreaking to witness the ongoing war crimes in Gaza, and it's time we use our consumer power to send a strong message.
Boycotting is our way of expressing solidarity with the innocent lives affected by the war on Gaza. These pro-Israeli and pro-US companies must understand that we won't support businesses linked to such atrocities. It's time to prioritize humanity over profit.
The people of Pakistan vowed to continue their boycott campaign till the complete ceasefire in Gaza.
These companies need to be held accountable for their affiliations with the US and Israel, and our collective stand can make a real difference.
The boycott has cast a shadow over the sales of superstores selling Western products in Pakistan, prompting a strategic shift in their offerings, giving more prominence to locally sourced items.
In response to intense boycott pressure, pro-Israeli companies are offering substantial discounts as a strategic move to regain customer trust after aligning with the US and Israel. This shows the complex interactions between geopolitical developments, consumer behavior, and national socio-political structures. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.